All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman. Today is our All 22 review episode of the Falcons Week 2 loss to the Dallas Cowboys. We'll talk about fans being let back into the stadiums starting in Week 5 and talk a little bit more about the big picture for the Falcons in the future and whether wins and losses matter all that much in 2020.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
This season, get football on your time with NFL Game Pass. See all the action from every game with full game replays. You can also replay an entire game and catch all the plays in just 45 minutes with condensed games. Go to NFL.com/Game Pass to start your free trial today. NFL Game Pass, where football never stops. So, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years. You know me on Twitter at FalcFans, and, of course, as the host of this preeminent Locked On Falcons podcast, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, right here on the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. In today's episode, we're going to talk about the Falcons Week 2 game and sort of some of my takeaways from the All-22, breaking down the sacks, the two sacks that were in this game, talking a little bit about some breakdowns in Falcons protection, as well as some attempts to be a little bit more creative on defense to generate pressure up front. In that conversation, it will lead to a question about examining the rules of onside kicks and whether that will get us into a conversation about whether or not the Falcons got jobbed by the refs when it came to the rule book, when they gave back the Cowboys a timeout, gifted them at the end of the game. And then our bulk of today's episode will be focused on the idea of tanking, whether or not losing in Week 2 is a blessing in disguise, as I lay out what I think is at stake for this Falcon team over the next 2 to 5 years. And when it comes to their potentially next head coaching hire, and that the hand-wringing and hair pulling that people will have from week to week over the wins and losses, and the idea of giving Dan Quinn the boot sooner rather than later, maybe a tad bit overrated. We'll get into that later on today's episode. But first, I want to get into that Locked On Falcons lead story, talking about Falcon fans being able to get back into the stadium in Mercedes-Benz, starting in week 5 against the Carolina Panthers, and maybe touch upon a little bit how that might factor into Dan Quinn's potential job status. The Atlanta Falcons announced on Tuesday that fans will be able to begin attending home games at Mercedes-Benz Stadium starting on October 11th when the team squares off against the Carolina Panthers. Previously, in mid-August, the team announced that fans would not be allowed in Mercedes-Benz for the team's first two home games during the month of September, those being their previously played game against the Seattle Seahawks in week 1, as well as their upcoming week 3 matchup against the Chicago Bears this week. There are no official announcements as to the number of fans that will be allowed to attend the upcoming October home game, but previous public statements by the team earlier this summer indicated that they will allow a limited capacity between 10 and 20,000 fans. Mercedes-Benz Stadium normally holds more than 71,000 for Falcon home games. Previous guidelines for fan attendance will involve all parties being required to wear masks, and seating will allow for social distancing of 6 or more feet. Those protocols include blocking off seating in certain sections of the stadium, including the first few rows behind team sidelines. There will be seating away from high traffic areas such as aisles, and fans will only be allowed to sit every other row. The team has also announced that this week's game against the Chicago Bears will be a quote unquote test run for the limited capacity allowed against the Panthers, with 500 friends, family, and associates of the team being allowed to attend this Sunday's game. This year, the Falcons' schedule alternates between home and away games every other week. So following their Week 5 matchup against the Carolina Panthers at home, they'll have another home game in Week 7 on October 25th versus the Detroit Lions before a Week 9 matchup against the Denver Broncos on November 8th. That game will precede the team's Week 10 bye week before a road game against the New Orleans Saints, and then two consecutive home games versus the Las Vegas Raiders and again against the Saints in Week 12 and 13, respectively. Their final home game of the season will come in Week 15 versus the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So far, the Falcons have played only one game in front of fans, and it was this past weekend's loss against the Dallas Cowboys. But their upcoming Week 4 road game against the Green Bay Packers will not have fans since Green Bay is following similar guidelines as the Falcons, as well as most teams around the NFL, by canceling fan attendance during the month of September and playing it by year thereafter. Obviously, letting fans back into the building comes with its fair share of questions, even beyond those surrounding the potential spread of COVID-19, especially when you consider the disappointing 0-2 start for the Falcons. Their next two opponents, the Bears and Packers, are both currently 2-0, and their most winnable game, at least looking right now, seems to be that Week 5 matchup against the 0-2 Panthers. The big question is whether or not current Falcons head coach Dan Quinn will survive long enough to be on the sideline for that home game against the Panthers if the Falcons can't find ways to win between now and then. Their Week 4 game against the Packers is in the national spotlight, given it will be played on primetime on Monday Night Football. Perhaps the fact that it comes later in the week helps Quinn's chances of still being employed, given if they do choose to fire him after that game. It would give whoever is their interim coach one less day of preparation for his first action against Carolina. Could that be a stay of execution for Quinn, who, after the Falcons' 0-2 start and embarrassing loss to the Cowboys in Week 2, seemed to make him a dead man walking? Well, that remains to be seen. So while the bigger concern this summer was whether or not the NFL would force fans that choose to attend games to sign waivers in relation to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, I think the current palpable frustration that most Falcon fans are feeling is that they're a lot more interested in seeing Dan Quinn sign a waiver, relinquishing him from duties as the team's head coach. There's your Locked On Falcons lead story, guys, and we're going to jump into the All 22 review portion of the game, and that will lead us focusing on the sack breakdowns, and that will lead us eventually into the rule changes and whether or not the officials cost the Falcons the game. We'll get into that conversation later up, but in talking about the breakdown of the sacks using that All 22, of course, I did that. You guys can too. And you can do so with NFL Game Pass. You can catch every snap from every game with full game replays. You can also get the condensed version of games if you don't necessarily have the time to watch a full game and just only have 45 minutes to see every snap of any game. It's all the action, all the football that you can handle all in one place. You'll also learn from the league's best players with over 40 NFL Game Pass film sessions. So you can check out Davante Adams, Amari Cooper, Eddie Jackson, get inside those players' perspectives as well as many others as they break down the concepts and techniques that make them some of the best in the business. NFL Game Pass also provides access to the entire NFL Films archive, so catch up on Good Morning Football, A Football Life, and Hard Knocks. Get it all by going to NFL.com/Game Pass to start your free trial today. NFL Game Pass, where football never stops. So today we're talking a little bit about the All 22, but in full disclosure, guys, I did not watch the entire game. I watched parts of the game, selected parts of the game so that I could answer some of these questions and aspects of the game. But to be honest with you, I wasn't that interested in going through the entire film, at least on Tuesday. I will, over the course of this week, we'll certainly touch upon some potential topics. Also, you know, tomorrow and later in the week when we sort of see what applies from this past weekend's film to this upcoming matchup against the Chicago Bears. But for obvious reasons, I wasn't necessarily feeling motivated to really dig deep on the film this week. But we'll sort of start things off talking about the sack breakdowns. That's a question from Riley Strite. He asked, can you break down the sacks again, please? The Cowboys' lone sack was Everson Griffin in the fourth quarter. The Falcons ran an RPO fake to Todd Gurley. They had three receivers on the field. Calvin Ridley, Olamide Zaccheaus was in for Julio Jones, and Russell Gage. None of those guys got open on that particular play, which caused Matt Ryan to sort of hold on to the ball. Matt Gano probably is credited for giving up the sack to Everson Griffin, but I really think this was a coverage sack. Griffin initially did not rush at the snap because he was held by the run action in the backfield. But then when he tried to rush, he tried to get outside. Gano was there to sort of stonewall that. But because Matt Ryan, in the initial setup of the play, was in shotgun and didn't have a three-step drop, he had a deeper drop. And so Gano's setup was good for that deeper drop. But then in the process of Matt Ryan waiting for receivers to get open, he sort of climbed the pocket. And instead of essentially upon his initial setup being 7 yards deep in the pocket, his climbing the pocket made him 3 yards deep in the pocket. Griffin was basically able to just, you know, get stonewalled going outside, but then sort of cross Gano's face, shoot back inside and make a beeline to Matt Ryan and get the sack. And I think mostly it was a coverage sack. Let's say like 88% of it was coverage. 10% of it was Matt Ryan and maybe some questionable pocket presence in terms of climbing a pocket. And then 2% of it was Gano. So that would be my breakdown of the Cowboys sack. The lone Falcon sack came in the first quarter on the Cowboys' second possession. The Falcons used an interesting blitz concept. I could break it down further, but I think without the aid of video, the visual cues, it would be kind of confusing. So the Falcons were trying to dial up a pressure concept. They were trying to get an overload. I think the Cowboys kind of figured it out. So I don't know if the concept that the Falcons were using was particularly effective. It led to a situation, a scenario where you had Tack McKinley, right, where the Falcons tried to disguise who they were bringing, and they were dropping guys along their defensive line into coverage, and it led to a situation where Tack McKinley was covering CeeDee Lamb like 15, 20 yards down the field. And had Dak Prescott been able to properly identify that, would have had a major mismatch and a potentially big gain for the Cowboys, which, again, it speaks to some of the issues. But I think ultimately that play was successful for the Falcons, not because of any sort of confusion that it created for the Cowboys in any significant way. It was just simply guys beat guys. And in this case, you had John Kaminsky, you had Deion Jones lining up on the left side of the defense against the right side of the Cowboys offensive line. And the Cowboys had enough bodies to pick up the pressure, but Kaminsky got a great jump on the ball and was able to blow past Terrence Steele and then run into Zeke Elliott, who was sort of in their backfield. And his assignment was to pick up Deion Jones around the edge. And because Kaminsky basically took out two blockers, Deion Jones was able to come cleaner and turn the corner, get to Dak Prescott, flush him up in the pocket, hit him. And, you know, Dante Fowler, who was rushing from the opposite end, kind of got stolen on his rush, but was in the right place at the right time to be able to knock the ball loose and sort of split credit on the sack with Deion Jones. Although technically Deion Jones did 90% of the work, and Dante Fowler just kind of had put his hand in the right spot and knocked the ball loose to create the fumble. So I think it was an interesting concept, but it was kind of the Falcons throwing junk at the ball. I think the Cowboys did a pretty good job adjusting to it, but just one guy in the Falcons case, John Kaminsky, kind of making the play happen more so than it was due to the concept that they were throwing at him. Riley's next question is, everyone is roasting us over the atrocious onside kick, and rightfully so. CJ Goodwin had a quote about there being a rule change that doesn't allow the receiving team to touch the ball until 10 yards either. I haven't heard this anywhere except from this quote, though after the game, that isn't a new rule that we're all missing, is it? I'll look for the article where he has a quote, but I've seen several articles where the Cowboys seem to imply that is the rule. So do you have any insight? So I went to NFL.com, double-checked the rule book, and as far as I can tell, the onside kick rules are the exact same that we all believe them to be, which is there are really no rules governing when and where the receiving team can touch the ball. Basically, the only rules in the onside kick playbook or basically say the receiving team has to line up 10 yards from where the opposing team is kicking the ball off. And mostly once the ball is kicked, they're free to do whatever they want. And the only rules in the rule book basically are governing how and when they can line up and who and how they can block and those various things, but not their ability to pick the ball up. So once the ball is kicked and it goes 2 yards, they can run at the ball and pick it up as far as I understand the rules. And so I don't know necessarily if that is what CJ Goodwin said is true. He must be looking at a different part of the rule book that I'm unaware of, or maybe Riley, you maybe just misconstrued the quote from what they were saying. I don't know. But as far as I know, that is not the rule. What I did notice when I did decide to go through the rule book in preparation for this question, I was like, hey, let me double check on this whole timeout thing, because it felt like the refs kind of jobbed the Falcons on that timeout at the end of the game in the fourth quarter, where Dallas called a timeout, then challenged the play, and the refs only charged them, instead of charging them two timeouts for the failed challenge, they charged them only one timeout. And based off of the rules, I understand it as I read, and I posted this on Twitter, the officials should have charged Dallas two timeouts instead of one. And for those of you that didn't watch or don't recall the exact circumstances, the Falcons had the ball. It was a second down with 4 minutes and 50 seconds left in the game in the fourth quarter. Dallas at that point prior to that play had two timeouts left. The Falcons ran the ball to Todd Gurley. He was marked down to get the first down on a second and four. 15 seconds after the whistle, the official announced that Cowboys had been charged their second timeout. Then a full minute later, as you're watching, you know, the broadcast and watching the Daryl Johnson and the other guy talking during that delay, a full minute later, you see the graphic for the challenge pop up on the screen. And then the officials announced that the Cowboys are challenging the spot. They wind up reviewing it. Gurley clearly crosses the line. So Dallas fails that challenge, and they should have been charged their final timeout there due to that failed challenge. That's what the rules state. But then the official comes on and said, basically, the Cowboys – did call a timeout before the challenge, but we're only going to charge them for the timeout for the challenge, which it seemed like he was basically saying, like, you know, we're giving them back a timeout for reasons. And so the Falcons then run it on first and 10. Gurley's hit in the backfield, I think largely due to Gano missing his assignment for a 2-yard loss. That prompts a second and 12. That leads to this, the Everson Griffin sack that we just broke down. Griffin gets a sack on that play, knocking back to third and 18. And then the Falcons wind up punting after that third and 18 failed conversion, and the Cowboys get the ball back with 2:57 left in the game. Now, if the Cowboys had been out of timeouts, if the officials had called it right, they wouldn't have been able to stop the clock at that point. And so the Falcons could have essentially ran the ball three straight times. And even if they didn't get a first down, they would have been punting the ball back to the Cowboys slightly before or slightly after the 2-minute warning. So basically a 1 minute less of time would have been on the clock. And that doesn't necessarily guarantee that the Falcons would have won the game by any means, but it does mean that if the Falcons were able to run the ball three straight times and get a first down, the game is over at that point. There's no way that the Cowboys can stop the game. So I'm not saying that the Falcons lost because of the officials and this mistake, because again, the Falcons had plenty of opportunities thereafter to win the game, including that onside kick. And of course, the Falcons failed to take advantage of those opportunities. But it did seem like the officials seemingly made a mistake that took away an opportunity for the Falcons to potentially win the game over the next, you know, 2 minutes at that point, and not have to rely on sort of their failed understanding of onside kick rules to sort of seal the game. So it could have been won earlier. Not saying it would have been had the officials not messed up, but just to me, a clear mistake. And those are the types of things when it comes to officiating that I tend to get upset with, like human error, judgment calls. Like, you know, you win some, you lose some. Over the course of an entire season, it'll probably on the whole balance itself out, that you'll win and you'll get more calls than you go against you, or an equal number that go against you, and it's not significant. But stuff like that, where the officials are seeming like, we decided not to charge the Cowboys a timeout, when it's like, no, the rules are that you should have charged them two timeouts, not one. But that's it. That will sort of wrap up our all 22 portion of today's episode. And I do want to get more into sort of whether or not wins and losses matter as much as maybe some people make them out to be. But before we get into that, I do want to plug that we are going to have a crossover episode on tomorrow's episode, in which we will talk a little bit more about some of the things that I saw on film and how they apply to this upcoming matchup against the Chicago Bears. And I will be talking with the host of Locked On Bears, Lauren Cox, about this week 3 matchup between the Falcons and Bears. So definitely want to stay tuned to this podcast. And if you aren't subscribed to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or some other platform, by all means, make sure you hit that subscribe podcast so you do not miss a second of tomorrow's Locked On Falcons, Locked On Bears crossover Thursday. So again, we are going to get into the conversation of whether or not wins and losses, and whether or not they matter all that much. And is there a silver lining to the Falcons losing in week 2? And speaking on silver and wins and losses, whether or not you guys know whether certain teams are going to win or lose, you should invest in your intuition. Use the promo code LOCKEDON and double your first deposit. New players get up to $1,000 in free play, designed to add more excitement to the sports that you love and the games that you bet. Your winning season begins today only at MyBookie. So this conversation, to me at least, because I'm less interested in diving into the film of the week 2 game, this conversation was a conversation I had with somebody on Twitter this morning, on Tuesday morning. I think it's a worthwhile conversation to have on this podcast. I've touched upon some of these issues on previous episodes, particularly on Q&As over the course of the summer, but we'll sort of reiterate some of those points. And this came about because, and this is not me calling out this person, but I've seen this sentiment be shared by multiple people. And, you know, because I can have a civil conversation with this person, I engaged him on this point rather than getting into it with other people that will resort in, you know, name calling and the types of things that we often get on Twitter. But basically, his premise was this idea that, you know, there's potentially a blessing in disguise for the Falcons losing to the Cowboys, or a silver lining or something like that, because it exposes the reality that this team has major changes that need to undergo. And if they had won, you know, we wouldn't be able to realize the truth of that's, underlying the situation. You know, I don't really agree with that premise, because I think it operates sort of off of the sort of binary that winning equals keep Dan Quinn keeping his job and losing means it potentially saves this franchise from itself, so to speak. I just kind of reject that premise off face value. But what I do want to talk about in that Twitter conversation turned into this is I think what we're going to see, or at least what I'm going to see from other people out there, not necessarily on this podcast, but other people over the next several months, which is I think a lot of people are going to treat every loss as a good thing because partially fueled by this premise, as well as the notion that tanking is good in the NFL. And I think tanking in the NFL is overrated. We've talked about this a bunch in recent years. I think basically unless you're trying to get a quarterback, then where you draft, particularly in the first round, is largely overrated. You know, there is a general trend that the higher you pick, the better your draft picks are, but I don't think that trend is as significant. And probably once you eliminate quarterbacks from the data set, it would probably be relatively insignificant. We know that, you know, drafting high for quarterbacks really, really is meaningful. You know, basically having a top 10 pick versus not having a top 10 pick essentially more than doubles your chances of hitting on a quarterback, which I don't think is necessarily the case when it comes to probably any other position. Now, you can certainly make an argument that at premium positions such as left tackle, pass rusher, cornerback, maybe even a wide receiver, because the premiums are at that position that you're not going to be able to find an elite player outside the top 10 at those positions. But we've seen enough evidence, enough occurrences of players like Aaron Donald, Ryan Ramczyk, Taylor Decker, Marcus Peters, Marlon Humphrey, Trey White, TJ Watt, Cameron Jordan, Chandler Jones, DeAndre Hopkins, Calvin Ridley over the last decade to know that you can get quality players at premium position well outside the top 10 in most drafts. So I say all this because it's building to the point that I think everybody tends to focus on tanking and losing. And I think the reality of the Falcons situation is like the wins and losses this upcoming season aren't as meaningful. I'm not saying they don't matter, but they're not as meaningful as I think people are going to act like they are over the next several months. I think the Falcons' success and failure, at least in terms of the quote unquote big picture, the long term outlook, is that the most likely, and this is me speculating and guessing and making at least what I hope are educated guesses, but obviously there are so many unknowns in this, so I don't want to necessarily be like, this is exactly how it's going to go down. But it, to me, like, this is a general, I think, realistic path of sort of where what direction this team is potentially heading in and sort of how they have to navigate that. But the likelihood, I think, is that the Falcons will probably target an offensive-minded head coach. That head coach will largely inherit the bulk of the current personnel on offense. You have guys like Ryan, Julio, Ridley, Hurst, Matthews, Lindstrom, Hennessy, McGarry. All these guys are going to be under contract at least through 2022. You're going to have guys like Gano and Gage potentially under contract next year as well. That head coach is largely going to be tasked with getting this offense operating back at the heights, largely through scheme change. You're not going to get too many major personnel changes from this year to next year on offense. I think, you know, you could potentially be looking to replace Gurley at running back, maybe improve the wide receiver tight end depth, add a backup quarterback to replace the GOAT Matt Schaub, maybe add a new starter at the left guard position and or, you know, tweaking some things, but you're not going to see a massive overhaul in offensive personnel. Meanwhile, on the defensive side of the ball, I think things are, relatively speaking, going to get blown up there. I think contract-wise, you're inheriting Grady Jarrett and Deion Jones' contract. Similarly, those guys are going to be signed through 2022. Dante Fowler's only really locked into one more year after this season. You got rookie deals for guys like Marlon Davidson, John Kaminsky, Terrell Sheffield. They're going to keep them in town through 2022 at least. Olakun Oliver are entering the final years of their rookie contracts next year. Who knows if they're starters. You can potentially cut bait this upcoming offseason with guys like Tyler Davidson, Alan Bailey, Ricardo Allen. Then you also have guys like Demonte Casey, Keanu Neal, Denard, and Tack McKinley all hitting free agency. And so I think there's a lot higher probability of turnover on the defensive side of the ball. And I think based off of their poor start so far this season, I think it's definitely deserves to be significant turnover. And, you know, people will look at the Falcons salary cap situation. I don't think it's as dire as some people will portray it to be, but I certainly think it's going to be an obstacle that this team is going to have to work around. And they're not going to necessarily be able to splurge on big name free agents in the near future. And they'll largely have to rely on hitting on draft picks and signing cheaper free agents. And I don't think, at least next offseason, that probably is as significant an obstacle as people will make it out to be, because I think the likelihood of the depressed salary cap league-wide is going to lead to a lot of quality free agents signing cheaper deals, one-year prove-it deals, than they normally would in a normal offseason. So I think the fact that the Falcons are potentially limited in some ways by their salary cap from making any big splashes in free agency won't be as disadvantageous next offseason as it would be in pretty much any other offseason in recent memory. So I think the dynamic you're going to have is similar to the Falcons next year upon the potential hiring of their next head coach is a dynamic similar to what you saw with the Rams a couple of years ago when they hired Sean McVay as the offensive guru. And then he also hired Wade Phillips to essentially be the head coach of the defense and, you know, took a hands-off approach and let Wade Phillips do his thing on defense. And, you know, that defensive coordinator basically gets to rebuild that defense mostly, relatively speaking, from scratch over the next couple of off seasons, while the head coach is tasked with basically, you know, using his superior play calling and scheme change to get more out of the current group of offensive players that the Falcons have right now. And so I think if that head coach is successful in getting that offense to into the top five conversation around the league, and that defensive coordinator is able to get that defense to respectability, put them in the top 15, top 20 range, I think you have a formula for success for this Falcon team to be very competitive and potential playoff contender in 2021, 2022, get this team back on track so that potentially by the time 2023 rolls around, you're potentially re-entering a Super Bowl window in the twilight of Matt Ryan's career over the next, you know, three or so years of his career that are potentially putting him at up to age 40, similar to what we have seen with the Saints the last couple of years as they're sort of, you know, making one last run with Drew Brees over the last 3 years. Now, if the Falcons' next head coach isn't successfully able to do those things, then you're probably looking at that timetable starting around 2023 where you're kind of blowing things up and starting over with a brand new quarterback. And you're hoping that the draft picks that you have between now and then, in addition to the Calvin Ridleys and the Chris Lindstroms and the Marlon Davidsons and the AJ Terrells, all those guys currently on the team, you know, develop enough in that time that you can sort of say those guys are going to be the new building blocks and replace the Julio Joneses and the Jake Matthews's and the Grady Jarrett's and the Deion Joneses of the world as sort of the foundational pieces of your team around that young, inexperienced rookie quarterback. And if those guys aren't, then you're potentially in a situation similar to what some of these other teams that have these young quarterbacks like the Giants, like the Bengals, like potentially the Jaguars, should they wind up, you know, using a top 10 pick next year on a quarterback, and you're not necessarily giving that guy a great head start, like similar where you're, you know, to other teams like Lamar Jackson or Patrick Mahomes, who, you know, inherited relatively established teams, playoff caliber rosters, and basically all their job was to get those teams over the hump for the most part and, you know, be the MVP guys, caliber quarterbacks that they are. And so that's important because that's going to lead to if the Falcons don't hit those marks, if these players don't turn into success and they don't hit on their draft picks over the next couple of years, you know, you're looking at a much more prolonged rebuilding process that, and if you factor in the possibility the Falcons don't hit on their quarterback pick, as they often say, you know, missing on a quarterback sets your franchise back 5 years, you're looking at the better part of a decade before the Falcons are really seriously back into contention, potentially. And that all kind of hinges on your head coaching hire. That all hinges on whoever the general manager is and their ability to navigate the cap situations and draft well over the next couple of years. And so I think those are really the more important things that matter for this team's long-term health. And the tendency for people to be like, hey, every loss helps this team get into a better situation. I understand it from a certain extent that every win lowers the chance that Dan Quinn gets fired. But I think, you know, I don't think we have to be so dramatic to be like a 1-1 start versus an 0-2 start. Like it, this sort of binary of like, you know, 0-2 guarantees Dan Quinn's going to get fired versus 1-1 guarantees that he's going to stay. I just think that's people being a little bit too dramatic. I think 0-2, you know, losing the Cowboys game, the only thing that really affects is the fact that Dan Quinn might get fired by week 5 as opposed to week 7, lasting to week 17. And again, I know other people, because of their belief that tanking is significant, will believe that, you know, keeping Dan Quinn that long and allowing the team to, you know, go 7-9 again this year versus, you know, firing him sooner rather than later and, you know, cementing a 3-13 season or something along those lines, whatever people have in their heads about what this team, you know, how bad this team has the potential to be if they just suddenly work towards, you know, they just stop working and fully embrace the tank. I think that stuff tends to be overrated because unless you're on in the camp of, I want the Falcons to use a top 10 pick or a top 5 pick on a quarterback. And I know there is a vocal contingent of Falcon fans that are in that camp, but unless you're in that camp, and if unless you're in the camp of, we got to replace Matt Ryan this offseason with Trevor Lawrence, which again, I think is not going to happen. I just don't think it's financially feasible for the Falcons to turn the page on Matt Ryan for at least another 2 years and at least until the 2022 draft. And that that's largely dependent on the next head coach and Matt Ryan playing really poorly in 2021 under the new head coach, and the new head coach being like, I can't work with this guy. You know, he's Alex Smith and he's not Drew Brees. That's that sort of conversation, which I think at this point in time, most of us would agree, or at least most of us would hope, is not going to happen. But I think the situation is that, you know, the Falcons tanking is not that important unless you're looking for a quarterback. And I don't think the Falcons are going to be or should be looking for a new quarterback next offseason. So, you know, the hair pulling and the hand wringing that I think people are going to have over the next 3 months, the inevitable about, you know, like, oh, you know, every loss is for the greater good and every win is against the greater good. I just think that's people being a little bit too dramatic because of, you know, these misconceptions about how important it is to lose games now and not really understanding what's really at stake. Yes, the Falcons need a new head coach, right? The Dan Quinn era is coming to an end. We can certainly get into a conversation at a later date on whether you can salvage the Dan Quinn era if, for whatever reason, the Falcons, you know, win, you know, 7 out of the next 9 games or something ridiculous like that. Is it salvageable? You know, I think you can have that conversation. Maybe it is if the Falcons were able to do that. But, you know, if they were only able to win like 4 out of their next 7 games, I don't think that's what we're talking about. But that's a conversation for another day. Maybe we'll get into that on a future episode. But, yeah, I just think, you know, people sitting here trying to put a positive spin on this loss, like, I don't think there's a positive spin that you can put. I think that's just a coping mechanism. Basically, you know, you just got dunked on mightily by the world and you're just basically like, it doesn't hurt. Like, it doesn't even matter. It's a good thing, right? You're just pretending, you're telling yourself that it's good that the Falcons are an embarrassing team and a laughing stock because you don't want to realize the alternative that it's a bad thing. So it's just, to me, people putting a positive spin on things. That's my thoughts on it. I think the big picture, the next head coach, next GM potentially, are critical for to decide whether or not this team is out there potentially competing for Super Bowls over the next 5 years or, you know, potentially a bottom dwelling team for the next 10 or so years. I think it has that level of importance. And that's why I think, you know, the week to week sort of wins and losses and people acting like these are the things that are going to make or break this team. Not to say that they're unimportant or inconsequential, but I think in the big picture, things aren't as important as people will inevitably make them out to be for the sake of drama over the next 3 or so months. So that's what I wanted to say, guys. That to me is where my head is at, more so than digging deep into the film. Tomorrow's episode, we will get into the preview of this week 3 matchup with the Chicago Bears and Locked On Bears, Lauren Cox. And if there's other additional thoughts as I finish watching the film, tonight, tomorrow, and in the rest of the week, I will bring those up on future episodes this week. Friday, we will probably have another Bears preview, and that will also be an opportunity for some of you guys to send in questions if you have them for upcoming show ahead of this weekend's game, or you have feedback that you want to provide to basically what I've just talked about for the last, you know, 15-20 minutes. Of course, you can send those in to Twitter at Locked On Falcons, via Facebook at Locked On Falcons, or via email at Locked On Falcons. And fans, since 1988, I did see your question as I was jumping on this podcast to record about the sort of first 15 gameplays, and we will get to that potentially tomorrow or on Friday. I will get to your answer to answer sort of my thoughts on Dirk Cutter's play calling in his game script later this week. But just because of this larger topic that I wanted to get into, I kind of had to punt on your question. So I apologize for that. But you guys can send in additional questions that we may be able to get later on the week as well to those aforementioned addresses. Check out NFL Game Pass and use the promo code Locked On when you sign up for my bookie to get a new $1,000 free play. So there you guys have it. Until then,
you are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.